Hello and welcome to Outside In. My name's John Burns, and this is another of my podcasts for people who like to be outdoors. And until fairly recently, I've been pretty restricted in what we can do. Let's hope the outdoors are opening up. And I don't know, maybe this will be one of the last of one of my podcasts. And as all of you will know, I'm sort of an aficionado, or I feel more comfortable in the north. And my guest today has been exploring the north pretty widely in his explorations of Greenland. And I think there can't be that many folk who know the place as well as he does. So I thought it'd be really interesting today to bring him along and get him to talk about his experiences in Greenland. I would like to welcome to the show Hugh Thomas. How are you, Hugh?
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks, John.
Hi, Hugh. No, so you were telling me you've been to Greenland 10 times, which is, I think that must be close on a record, I would have thought.
Yeah, that's right. Since 2006, I've been there 10 times, and I'm not done with the place yet.
Oh, right. Okay. There's plenty more to see. But I was saying, you know, you obviously, you didn't start with Greenland. What got you interested in the outdoors generally at first?
I think very simply, I was born in Snowdonia. So I spent much of my youth in those hills. From my early teens, I used to go fishing during the night up in some of those lakes. A lot of fishing during the day. So I think that's pretty much how I became very comfortable being in the outdoors, and especially how I became comfortable being out there on my own.
Oh, right. So you started out with fishing. It's funny because I think one of the things that got me into the outdoors was I was always being dragged out to ponds in Merseyside by my dad fishing. And I think it does. You spend a lot of time in the outdoors if you do that, and you do tend to feel comfortable there. So what interested you specifically at first then about Greenland itself?
I think I've always been interested in the polar extremes, but left it a bit late in life to get into anything more extreme in that sense, as it were. But I always had an interest in Greenland, this very large island where you didn't really hear much anything about what happens in Greenland. It was a bit mysterious. And I'd been sort of pondering maybe going to take a look at the place. And there was a chance meeting on the West Highland Way in 2005 with two Danes, where they mentioned to me this trail they'd done in Greenland the year before and found it a bit of a challenge but rewarding. And that got me, that ignited, I suppose, the determination then to actually make it happen. So I did a lot of research as much as I could. Back in then, there were no blogs and guidebooks and websites, etc. for it. So I found out what I could and then decided in 2006 I would go out there and find this trail and have a crack at it. And that's where it started. It was going to be a hiking trip. One trip and probably tick it off, as most people do, and then go do something else. But I had to abort it that year because my friend, whom I agreed to take with me against my better judgment, wasn't up to it. So we didn't complete the trail that year, and I determined to go back in the next year, 2007, and do it alone, which I did. And that immersion of solitude in that landscape really brought me into it. And something got its hooks in me. And since then, I've got two primary reasons why I go back there, and I've been going back there since then basically as often as I can.
For someone who doesn't know Greenland, I certainly don't know Greenland, describe the place to us if you can. I mean, it's a massive place, but what's Greenland itself like then?
Yeah, it is an enormous island, and there's so much of it I would really like to see. It's much of it is obviously inaccessible. So this particular trail, which is now becoming increasingly popularly known, and there's Paddy Dillon's guidebook to it and so on, is on the west coast between Sisimiut on the coast, which is Greenland's second largest town, and Kongerluswerk, which is an inland town that used to be an American air base. So that's the classic ACT trail of about 100 miles or so. In summer, that area isn't, you know, snow and ice covered, so you can walk from the coast right up to the edge of the ice sheet if you want to. It's a lot of east-west valleys and ridges, largely, with huge lakes,
right,
number of lakes. No trees, obviously, just beautiful Arctic vegetation. So it's a very, very open landscape, and you can easily sort of just find, you know, it looks much the same in every direction.
And there's a huge ice cap, I'm right in thinking, isn't there?
Yeah, the ice sheet is very impressive. And if you go about 14 miles east from Kongerluswerk along a dirt track road, which was well, was is the longest road in Greenland at the moment. You can get to the edge of the Arshid at a very popular spot called the Russell Glacier, which is a very impressive sight for those of us not used to living in a country with ice. When you stand in front of a wall, you know, about 90 feet or so high of ice, it's a very impressive thing to see.
And this of course, extends for mile after mile. Are there actually routes? Is it, what about crossing the actual ice cap itself? Is that something that is feasible?
Yeah, there are people who do that, quite a lot of it. I was talking to a professional company, I think, about a year ago, who guide that. It's something I'd kind of be interested in doing. Question of finding the time, I suppose. So it's something I would like to do. I do some winter trekking. I've done the ACT in winter, which was my 10th visit. That's how I celebrated my 10th visit. So that was last March, just before the pandemic, or as the pandemic was breaking globally. Right. I was blissfully unaware because I was alone on the trail in the frozen whiteness.
Oh, right. So probably the best place to be quite honest. So sorry, the ACT, that's the Arctic Circle Trail. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about that those trails then. How long are they?
Well, the Arctic Circle Trail is roughly about 95 to 100 miles long. It's a really nice introduction to West Greenland hiking if you want to do it. But I've got a different sense because for me, I'm very familiar with areas way off the trail. Trail itself can be daunting for first timers. It's well marked. It's reasonably easy to pick out in the landscape a lot of the time. So you don't need intense navigation. It's got a few huts along the way that you can use if they're free as shelters, but you should bring a tent too. It is a nice introduction, but it's quite a long walk through a very open landscape. And once you start, obviously you either finish or you turn back, because in summer there are no roads, you know, buses and trains and whatever. You leg it one way or the other. But for me, having done the trail, that feels a little pedestrian to me by now. Spend most of my time way off the trail.
And presumably way off the trail is pretty remote country. I mean, I don't know what the population of Greenland is, but I'm assuming that basically a lot of it is empty. Is that right?
Yes, the population is about 57,000 and they all pretty much live on the coast. Yeah. So in this area, there are only two towns, Sisimiut on the coast, which is about 5,000 inhabitants, and Kongsvingerfjord, 100 miles away inland, which is about 500 inhabitants, and that's it. You know, the next nearest towns are going to be 100 miles or so up or down the coast. So once you head into the interior, apart from Kongsvingerfjord, there's pretty much nothingness. So it's very, very remote. And one of the reasons I love going off trail is to get complete isolation and a sense of that remoteness and solitude. I love immersing myself completely in that landscape without the distraction of other people around me. Mm-hmm. Although when I do some of the goose work that I help out with out there, I am then working with a team. So I do a sort of something that's communal out there, you know, with a team of people. But I also love time alone in that complete wilderness, far from everybody else, completely isolated.
Well, maybe you could tell us about the goose work in a minute. But I'm interested to know, how do you keep yourself supplied? I mean, how do you actually, because obviously there aren't going to be shops there, are there?
No, I mean, there's a couple of shops in town in Kongsvingerfjord, and there's some decent shops in Sisimiut. My plans vary. For example, in 2018, what I will do usually, I'll start from Sisimiut and I'll walk for about 8 days to reach a point in the east where I normally like to camp. So I'm not usually heading to Kongsvingerfjord. I'm heading somewhere north of that in the remote landscape. I'll do that in about 8 days with some spare food on me. Right. My pack normally weighs about 36 to 39 kilos.
Okay.
and then I'll drop into town and pick up more supplies and then stay out there, because I can't carry, you know, 3 or 4 weeks worth of food.
No, you can't. That's what I was thinking.
But in 2018, what I did was I did the hike. The following day, I dropped into town, picked up the rest of my food, stashed it in the landscape under a pile of rocks and stuff, and then just explored around in the area. Well, visited areas I know in the area, as it were, with a stash of food in the landscape, so I didn't have to go back into town. Right. So that year, I managed to get 17 days and nights completely alone without seeing another human anywhere. And that isolation was just incredible, an intense experience of complete solitude for almost 3 weeks in that beautiful landscape.
And have you got any means of contacting anyone during that period then?
Yeah, I always carry an Iridium phone just for, you know, for emergencies. And for my winter trek, because I was going to be crossing, you know, frozen lakes and that kind of thing solo out there, I did take a Garmin InReach with me.
Right. So the winter trek, you were crossing frozen lakes, and was that? Do you take a polka or anything like that? I would only sledges or.
Yeah, I did. I've completed the ACT once in summer, as I said. Most of the
Right.
time now, I use just a few days of it, and then I come off on a route of my own that I plotted to give me that isolation going
Yes,
far off the
yes.
trail. So, from what I thought, for my 10th visit, to celebrate my 10th visit, I'd revisit the ACT and do it in winter instead. So, I had a pulk, it was about 69 kilos, I think, roughly.
Right.
And I did the trail basically in winter, which is fantastic because lakes I'm very familiar with and valleys and everything I know really well. Normally, obviously, I have to go around the lakes, but it was a wonderful, lovely experience to be able to just go across the surface of them. And some of them
Right.
are huge. The longest lake there is about 22 miles long, although you only traverse a part of it. But another lake is about 14 miles long, and you spend the whole day pretty much on that one. The
So,
landscape is completely different in winter, but it's a great experience.
and what sort of temperatures are you talking about in terms of what's the weather like in winter?
I was there in March in 2020. The week before I arrived, it was dipping below minus 40, and it was reaching about
Ouch.
minus 33 when I was there.
Oh,
There
right.
were some people taken out with frostbite. And strangely, one afternoon, I arrived at one of the huts, a Catific hut, and I could see a polk outside. And I thought, oh, somebody's already here. And then there was no one around, and the polk was just there. And when I finally got to town, I spoke to a friend of mine who's a police officer out there who said that that was a Frenchman they took out with frostbite, and they'll be going back to get his polk later to send it on to France for him. So, people were getting frostbite. It is pretty damn cold. You need to be prepared for that kind of cold if you're going to do the trail in winter.
I mean, that's serious cold, isn't it? That's not messing about. And
Anything below
how?
minus 30 is pretty cold, yeah.
Yeah. And where did you? How did you get your sort of? I'm interested to know how you develop the skills to be able to survive in that environment, particularly on your own, because the margin for error if you're on your own is pretty narrow, isn't it?
Well, I think certainly things are very different in winter, and little simple things you do without thinking, in summer, it's very different when everything is cold, your hands are cold, you can't expose them for too long, and that kind of thing. Basically, I did a trek across the Hardangervidda in Norway as a sort of preparation to my Greenland stuff because I hadn't done a lot of pulking before.
Yeah,
So I do that. Group of four of us, I think, did that to get some practice in. And that was the year before, so I was planning a year ahead. And then I just got all my kit and flew it all out there to Greenland, and then did the trail.
and what when you how difficult was it to decide on your kit itself? Because obviously as you know, it's pretty crucial to get the right gear in the right place. I mean, you make a mistake and take the wrong item where you haven't got what you need, and that can be a major issue. So where did you do that research then?
Well, I drew on some the experience of what we did on the Hardangervidda. One of the guys there was a professional guide. So I thought I'd go and not be arrogant. I'd go and absorb what I can learn from this chap, as it were. And that pretty much told me what I need. And I did find a lot of the time, a lot of it is still the same common sense you use as an experienced hiker, but you just need to know about the subtle differences and some of the really good, useful, tips and things and getting into a routine when everything is really cold and you can't fiddle about too long. You just fairly disciplined about what you do. I felt that was enough prep. And for me, actually, the trail itself, obviously, it feels like somewhere I know so well that, it wasn't that daunting. I just needed the kit and off I went.
Right. And what about water supplies, things like that, in those sort of conditions then? How do you manage for
Yeah.
that?
Stuff the way we did it in Norway is kind of what I adopted, really. So I had a thermos flask which I'd fill up with water, hot water in the morning. I had a couple of insulated Nalgenes for cold water, although that big they began to froze inside them.
Right.
So you do need to manage your water because obviously the only access to it will be to melt stuff. So I kept myself out in the morning with enough water, including a hot flask. That sees me through to the evening. And then you do your routine again, melting more snow, etc. So that's the kind of routine I think if people want to do it in winter, you need to sort of know what your routine is going to be, and have a disciplined plan. In summer, of course, so much water out there, and people ask me, do I need to bring filters and stuff? And no, the water is so pure and beautiful out there, you can just drink gallons of it and you're fine.
Oh God, yeah, I'm sure you can. I mean, but it must be quite demanding in terms of the quantity of fuel you've got to take then.
You're carrying a lot more fuel, certainly. And I sort of did a bit of online research, you know, about what how people were sort of estimating how much fuel they need and how many burns they need. And it obviously depends how many burns you're going to have. I'm fairly minimal, really, in the met fuel use. When I do the trial in summer for 8 days, about 900 mils of fuel from my MSR stove is enough to see me through that trial. I'm not excessive in terms of making brews and stuff like that. So you did have to, I did have to estimate the quantities, right? And I did little things quite amusing. You know, I bought a load of chocolate bars in Sisimiut, and my accommodation, I sliced them up into chunks and put them in the daily ration packs for lunch, because I've heard of people breaking teeth, you know, on solid chocolate bars.
Well, I can vouch for that. I've done that myself.
So a little prep, little steps of prep like that were quite satisfying when on the trail I thought, well, that's nice and easy. I'm not going to break any teeth here.
No. Yeah, frozen chocolate's pretty hard stuff in my experience. It was harder than my teeth, anyway. And you think I'm really hungry and going to eat this, and there's a sudden crack, you know? So you said earlier on you'd done some goose work. Well, what do you mean by that? What exactly you've done with the
Well, I've got my personal motivations for going on. I love the landscape out there, and I've become to feel like I almost belong there now. So I usually make sure I get some personal time, hiking time out there. And a friend of mine, a couple of scientists, they had a study out there of the Greenland white-fronted goose going on since the 70s on and off. And because of their professional schedules, you know, the time they can get out there is fairly limited around that. And this study actually featured on BBC's Spring Watch, I think it was maybe last year or some. So my friend, my going out there in 2006 and 7 revived his interest in starting up some more field work. So in 2008, I joined the team he put together, and we go out there to this particular study area. And the routine normally would be that we would round up the geese, ring them, you know, take a whole load of biometrics, etc., count the population, and it all adds data to try to understand what's going on with a Greenland white-fronted goose, which is kind of an endangered species. The population's only around 80 to 20,000 in the whole world. Their range is only between Greenland and Ireland and the UK, pretty much, and they stop in Iceland each spring and autumn during their migration. It's a beautiful, charming goose, but very, very small population, not a great set of breeders. And there's a lot of Canada geese in the area that population is growing exponentially. So they're interested in understanding what they can do to conserve the Greenland goose. So that gives me an extra sort of justification for going out there, because I'm doing something to help with science as well, which is satisfying. And some years we don't catch them, we just count the population, etc. But I literally basically go on wild goose chases in the Arctic.
I never thought of that. Yeah, that's certainly the case. Yeah.
It's good fun.
So you've done, obviously, you know, 10 trips is a lot for anyone. I just wonder, what is it, have you got any sort of ambitions left there that you'd like to do?
You know, it's not. I found when I'm going out to West Greenland, I kind of bonded with the place somehow, and it's not about clocking up achievements. Friends say to me, you know, you've been there 10 times, aren't you bored, etc.? And it's very hard to explain to people how completely immersive and satisfying the isolation is out there and the connection with the place. So I just can't get enough of that. And so at the moment, I'm thinking that I might go and do the ACT again this coming winter. I've got a job to take a field team out there in next July to do a whole lot of goose sampling for wildlife disease surveillance. So that's for a large European project where they want biological samples for wildlife disease surveillance. So I've got a task there to take a team out there that year. And I'll probably keep going out there. And I find that when I'm out in that landscape completely alone in the silence, maybe with a great northern diver calling on the lake, which is a beautiful, evocative sound of the wilderness. If you don't know what the great northern diver's call is like, look it up on YouTube. It's a beautiful sound. You'll recognize it probably from the Canadian wilderness sort of thing. But I find when I'm out there, the downtime, the off-grid time away from my busy, normal human life, and what I refer to as the ugliness of the human world, really, is really deeply rewarding, just to connect with pure nature for a while in a landscape unspoilt, you know, unmarked by humanity, pretty much. It's just a beautiful ecosystem that's intact. And it's a reminder of what how beautiful nature can be, to just be there and immerse all your senses in it.
Yeah, I mean, I in a very small way, I like to go sort of to fairly remote parts of Scotland and be on my own. And I'm sort of looking at the moment maybe to travel to a few islands and be, I suppose, sort of marooned there for a while, you know. I've spoken to quite a few people who enjoy the outdoors, who enjoy doing those things on their own. And I think, I don't know if you feel this way, I think there is a different quality to the experiences that you have as a solo walker or a solo camper or being on your own. You're more, I think, in tune with the land that you're walking through or moving through than you are with somebody else. I suppose I'm fairly antisocial, really, but I always find if you're with somebody else, I suppose you bring society and the wider world with you, and they're always going to be talking about what a pain in the ass their wife is, or how they're going to get a better car tomorrow, or whatever. Does that make sense to you?
I completely relate to that, John. Yeah, I'm not antisocial. You know, when the years when we've got goose work to do, I'm with a team out there, and it's great fun. It's great camaraderie. It's a really lovely experience. And for the team I take out next year, many of them have not ever been to Greenland, so they're excited and looking forward to it. But when I'm alone, I agree also what I find is without the distraction of another human, all my senses are just taking in my surroundings. And I find that deeply rewarding. My mind is freed up from all the stuff I normally have to force it to think about every day at home. And people say to me, you know, don't you get bored, or what do you think about? And it's kind of hard to explain that. I'm never bored out there, when I'm alone. And my mind, it just thinks about whatever it wants to think about. And I find the whole experience deeply immersive. Observations I've made in my journals, like, it's totally quiet outside now. The wind's died down. I can hear the wings of a moth fluttering on my fly sheet. Those little moments like that of quality time in nature on my own are beautiful. There's a photo I took. I was away one night in 2018, and there were a hell of a lot of mosquitoes out that night, so it wasn't pleasant outside the tent.
All right,
But I was
okay.
waiting for midnight, and I knew that at midnight the sun would be just resting on the horizon of the hills opposite me. So just before midnight, I got out the tent and set up the camera on a little 5 second timer or something. And I got this shot of me silhouetted against the hills with a sort of still like glass lake in front of me and the midnight sun in the sky. And that's the sort of little precious moments, you know, that were private to me alone, a personal experience that I take away thinking, just love those moments out there and on my own like that.
Yeah, I mean, I travel, but when you could travel to Bothies in Scotland, I think they're opening again fairly shortly. But I like them to go on my own, and it's a strange thing. I often maybe I'll take a book, or I'll take maybe something to listen to or whatever. But most of the time in those places, I find there's just a sort of sheer enjoyment, actually, in just being there. And people ask me, "What do you do?" Well, mostly I just stare at the space, really. Is that kind of
Yeah,
what you do?
I've taken books before and found I never had time to read them, bizarrely.
It's right, it's right, it's
You
right.
know, I'll walk all day. I know the area. I know where I'm going. I don't need to be reading maps. I know the landscape. I can visualize my way around a huge area of that wilderness there because I know it so well. I do things like, I love sitting with the muskox. Now, you have to be careful approaching muskox, especially when they've got young, but I've been doing it quite a while now. And if they let you get close, I just sit in the vegetation quietly, a single human, so I'm not disturbing them, not spooking them. And moments like that, sitting with them as they go about their business, are just sort of a deeply rewarding connection with nature. I've sat with Arctic hares many times,
Yes.
quietly, they vanish away. The wildlife I see, the huge variety of birds. It's Arctic foxes. All those little moments and experiences just seem to fill my time and the sheer joy of being out there. And it's kind of added that I'm not having to navigate because I know the landscape better now. It feels like I've totally relaxed there and feel like I belong almost, which is, strange for such a remote place. I never thought I'd get to that situation with a part of remote West Greenland.
Well, it sounds like you probably feel more at home there than you do at home, really. Is that more?
I can certainly say I know this region between of about 100 or so miles wide and then a huge area in the east, north of Gondwana, better than I know parts of the UK for sure.
Well, you paint a fascinating picture. It sounds like a wonderful place. And
I'm torn between this idea of wanting to guide people out there so they can experience that remote wilderness far off the trail and get the real thing, if you like, and preserving what I get from my solitude out there. And that's been a dilemma I've faced for a few years now. But I think when I retire, amongst my plans might be that I would offer to guide people way off the trail so they can really experience that remote wild landscape.
Yeah. Yeah, and so for folk who are interested, you're an extensive blogger. I think you've got quite a lot of blogs to write. So in the future, is that right?
Well, I've started a little blog site. Yeah, I've written up two of my hikes there. I wanted to give people a chance to even from their armchair to experience, you know, a hike out in West Greenland.
Absolutely.
And it might inspire some people to go out there.
Yeah,
I haven't written up the goose stuff, and I've got my winter hike to write up. So when I have time, I've got a lot more to do. And I'm sort of, friends have encouraged me to say, you should write a book about this stuff because you've spent so much
time. Sounds like it. Yeah. Well, that's of course, you'll then hit the dilemma that, I write about the hills and stuff. My dilemma is constantly that I'm either out there doing it or sitting on my backside writing about it, wanting to be out there doing it. So I'm never quite. There's a bit of a contradiction there. But anyway, what I'll do, let's hope you do put pen to paper, because I think you've got some fascinating experiences there that would be great to share with people. And what I'll do, I'll put a link to your blog. And I think you mentioned a book, a guide, did you, at one stage?
There's a guidebook to the trail written by Paddy Dillon through the Cicerone Press stuff, and I think he updated it the other day. Paddy's walked the trail a couple of times.
I'll put a link to Paddy's book and some images, some of the great images that you've got on the podcast page. And let's hope that it inspires a few people to want to come with you and for your next business when you're retired. How's that?
If people want to do the trail, there is a Facebook page for it as well that I'm an admin.
Oh, right, okay.
There's a lot of information out there for the trail, but I also do answer a lot of personal messages for people who want to ask questions about hiking out there.
Great, that's fantastic. Well, that was really fascinating talking to you, Hugh. Thanks very much for coming on the show, and I hope you enjoy your travels in Greenland and remote places in the future. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, John.